Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte. Episode 27 for March 14th, 2008. Ward Cunningham. This show and the entire TWiT broadcast network is brought to you by donations from listeners like you. Thanks. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that talks about free Libre open source software. Our host, Randall Schwartz, is here, the author of Learning Perl and about a dozen other Perl books, including his newest, Pearls of Wisdom.
Hey, Leo. Good to talk to you again. It's been so long, and I mean that in the most facetious way, because we're starting to get this. I'm going to get really used to this. We're starting to get this on a week-by-week basis. I can't believe it. Floss Weekly.
Don't get your hopes up, folks.
At least for the last week and this week.
I think it's great. And not only that, but talking to some of the most interesting minds. In fact, today I am so pleased. I've been looking forward to this for some time. We talked to a man who has changed... not just the face of programming with his concept of extreme programming, agile programming, but also with his very simple concept that is now everywhere, the wiki. Ward Cunningham is our guest today. You want to tell us a little bit about Ward? Yes. You know him, right?
I've known Ward for quite a while. He's a fellow Portlander, so we actually go way back. In fact, I first discovered him sort of indirectly. I don't think I actually had any conversation with him, but I first discovered him way back in 1981 and back at Tektronix, because he was part of Tech Labs, the actual group that had taken the Smalltalk 80 image from Xerox PARC and put it onto a piece of hardware that Tech was producing internally called the Magnolia, and he was part of that team. So he's been playing with Smalltalk since the very early days. And as a result of that, he went on to continue with Smalltalk and develop things like extreme programming, which is how do you get a bunch of programmers in the same room working on a weekly or even like bi-daily delivery that actually makes sense and can be tested by the customer and updated by the customer. And so I've actually been tracking him over the years. It's been sort of, well, not stalking him, but just tracking him. And I actually had the privilege of a couple of years ago bumping into him at a Portland Linux users group meeting. And it was great because we actually got a chance to catch up. And, you know, what was funny about that is like all these years had gone by. And of course, he comes up to me and he knows I'm big in Perl, I mean. And he goes, you know, the original wiki was written in Perl. And I went, really? And he goes, yeah, and it was written in Perl, and it's pretty ugly code, but, you know, I just wanted to let you know, you know.
So
we had this background of shared experience, you know, that he had created this thing called the wiki, and that he had used, I think he says he used my book to do the code, which is great. I was just like, so here's this connection I had, and now of course modern day with Wikipedia and things like that. I really wanted to bring him on, and I've been working the last few weeks to bring him on, because I thought, here's a guy who's really established the framework of wikis and collaborative work with agile programming and extreme programming and stuff. So I'm really excited about today's show too. This is really going to be a good show.
Well, let's say hello to Ward Cunningham. So first of all, I guess we should talk about what you're doing right now. You're at aboutus.org. Is it a wiki site?
It is. It's a large wiki. We've got 10 million pages and 5 million unique visitors a month.
And who is it about? It's about us?
It's about all of us. What we do is we take the about page that's usually lost and forgotten on a typical website and make it a page of a wiki.
Is it done automatically, or do people have to go there and do it for themselves?
Well, if you want it to look good,
you know. You're not. So you are scraping some pages, or no?
Yeah, we'll do on-demand scraping, so we can say confidently that you do have a page on About Us, even if even if you just got your domain yesterday.
Oh, that's nice.
I mean, for example, they went to Stonehenge.com, my page, and they scraped off my sort of about page on Stonehenge.com, and there were a couple of things that were wrong, but only because they're wrong on my website right now. So I fixed it on the wiki, which is great. I actually updated the address and updated a contact address on there, and it was just great. They let me fix it for me.
This is very
cool. A lot of people, it turns out, even though they paid somebody to make them a website, it's easier to change the wiki than it is to change their own website.
Yeah, that's true. One of my, I do a radio show, and the radio show website's a wiki. And initially I did it because I thought, oh, what a perfect example of a place for a community to add value. So I will do the radio show and I'll put the show notes in there. And then initially it was wide open. We had a little spam problem, so I started to give out a password on the show, figuring, well, the spam bots won't be able to get that. And that worked, except then there were human spammers who started using it. And I guess I just didn't have a big enough community to keep it clean or something. So I eventually turned off the wiki, the public wiki part, but I still use it because it's easiest for me to update the page that way.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I type wiki, it's automatic.
So we might want to start with just what is a wiki? What is it all about?
Well, I think the most important thing about a wiki is that you do your updates in the same place you do your reading. You don't have to go to some different path or different tool to make a change. So when you're reading and you see something that needs improving, you become a writer and editor, and that the transition is very smooth.
The interesting thing is, as I remember it, that was Tim Berners-Lee's original idea for the World Wide Web, was he could post his physics papers and his colleagues could edit them or modify them or comment on them.
Yes, he always imagined. In fact, he imagined it being WYSIWYG, and that's still, elusive. But there's another thing going on, which is a little more subtle, and that is that when you make a site that's a wiki, it always tends to be just about the right size. So if you've got a new community and you got 20 pages, you can all learn those 20 pages and move through them really well. And as the community gets bigger and you get up to 100 pages, well, that's about the right number. And the 101st or the 1001st, just shows up at the right time.
How did you get this concept? How did it come to you?
I wanted to have something where I could describe incomplete knowledge, and the actual project I was trying to do is I wanted to have I wanted to track the history of ideas as they floated through my company.
Wow.
Which was this was back when I worked at Tektronix, and I said I just want to know every project and every person that worked on those projects and every idea they carried from one project to the next. And I thought that that's how ideas really moved around the company, not by somebody reading a book, but by somebody seeing something work well and say, I'll do that again.
So what was your design spec for something that could do that?
Well, I tried to implement it in HyperCard.
Oh yeah.
And it had this notion of cards, so I said I need a card for every person and a card
linking
for every project.
Yeah.
And a card for every idea. And then I designed my first card, and then I realized I could use the same card for everything. If I put a person's name at the top, it'd be a person card.
Right.
If I put a project name at the top, it'd be a project card. Now, the one thing that I didn't use out of HyperCard is the way you made a link on HyperCard is you would go to your destination, and you say, make a link, and right. It made a cute little link icon, and then you copy that or cut it.
Painful.
And go back to the source page and paste it.
Right.
And the problem with that is it really required that the destination exists before you ever make a link to it. And that didn't fit my incomplete knowledge, because I knew I couldn't get every project or every idea or every person at Tektronix. So I wanted to have something where there was a kind of a frontier between the known and the unknown. So you'd have all these pages that were known, and then you get to these places where, we know about that, but we haven't said anything about it yet. And if you know about it and feel like typing, go ahead and start.
That is, I guess that really is, if you had to pick one feature of Wiki, that's it.
Yeah, and that's what makes it grow to be the right size. And being the right size is very important, because if you're in some database that somebody envisioned being fantastic,
right,
and it's all empty, you know, you just bounce around and say, oh, this is too complicated for me.
Right.
Or if you make it really simple and you start working, you know, well, pretty soon you fill it up and it's too crowded. And you're saying, can you change the schema on this database so I can do a little more?
So did you see it as a database originally, just as a simple database?
Well, I wanted it to be a database that didn't involve like rows and columns. Right. I wanted it to be a store. And, you know, I wasn't even sure that hypertext would do it, but I thought it could. I just wanted to try it. And it worked so well that I couldn't get people to stay away from my desk. You know, they'd come by and want to type a few more projects into my HyperCard, but it wasn't on a network. So they had to sit there and use my computer.
Oh, that's funny. Just by putting something in camel case, having an intercap says there's going to be a link to this, links to some document, but it's not created. It's just kind of in there. And so I get your point where if somebody doesn't feel like that document needs to be created, it isn't.
No, not until somebody feels like typing.
Right.
On the other hand, if it's already exists, it is linked. And that's the best part about it. Like, for example, I was just going earlier today to the Wiki Engines page, and I noticed you didn't have one of the Smalltalk wikis. This is on your C2.com site. And I noticed there wasn't a link to Peer, which is the Seaside Smalltalk wiki. And as I linked that up, I said, it's a content management system. So I put content management system in camel case. And it linked. It was already an existing page. And I went, wow, there we go. There's a keyword that already links to a whole body of text about content management systems. And I didn't have to know that that was already there. It just automatically linked it for me. And if I hadn't, it would have been a link that says, go create this page. I think that's the beauty of a wiki.
Yep. It's a simple little trick, but it's amazing how well it works.
So the first, I shouldn't say the first, but the best known, certainly not the first, but the best-known wiki, of course, is Wikipedia. Originally, it was the idea was a web-based encyclopedia. Larry Sanger started it, but it wasn't a wiki at first. It wasn't until it was a publicly editable wiki that Newpedia turned into Wikipedia and became what it is. The wiki made it.
It was a group of people kind of figured out this wiki thing, and they had enough passion about encyclopedias, it became what they envisioned, even though they weren't sure where they were going when they started.
Right. I use it as an example. Actually, I want to know, Ward, if that's appropriate or if you feel that's a good example. It seems like it's the best known wiki.
Oh, for sure. Now, a funny thing is that Wikipedia reversed a lot of design decisions I made, but they didn't reverse them until they had a pretty good feel of what it was like to be on a wiki. Of course, I reversed a bunch of design decisions when I went from HyperCard to the web because it was just a different set of tools. So what's important, though, is this idea that, you know, as we were talking about, that, you know, when you're reading, you can become a writer, and when you become a writer, there's a room enough to write.
Mm-hmm.
And they've preserved that to this day. So I call it a wiki.
So you were working in HyperCard, and you said, I obviously have to go beyond HyperCard. Did you implement it in C the first time you did it? Or
No, I implemented in Perl. It was actually my first Perl program. And Randall, I read your book, and I just copied stuff out of the back of the book and made it work.
Randall, you had a hand in the invention of the wiki.
There you go.
I've been everywhere. It's true.
Now you can die happy. No.
Yeah, it's a bit of an embarrassment because I learned enough Perl to get the job done, and then I got the job done, and I thought, well, gosh, I got to get some real Perl experts to help me make this beautiful, and I never got around to making it beautiful, so I've almost been a little apologetic about the code.
So that was that called Wiki, the first Wiki?
Yeah. I can't remember what I called it when I first made the CGI, but I could tell within a day that it was going to be hot.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I said, I need a good name for this.
And you chose to name it after the Wiki buses.
Yeah. Well, I almost called it Quick Web.
Oh, I'm so glad you did.
Basic. And then I knew that, you know, because I'd been to Hawaii and I'd caught that crazy bus that wiki meant very quick.
It's a much better name.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny how there's a certain serendipity in something like this taking off? And, of course, naming is very important. Mm-hmm. And yet when it's the right thing, it gets named properly. I mean, it just works.
You know, there was something in my back of my mind while I was doing all this. And of course, when I talk about all the history of ideas at Tektronix, I was interested in the history of computer programming ideas, and especially the ideas that go into programs done well versus, say, programs done poorly. And I think what happens when you're programming, you're doing something very similar to making a wiki. You know, you start with the parts you know, and you kind of go up to that frontier where, you know, you mean to call a routine, but you don't have that routine written yet. So you make a stub. That's kind of like a red link. And then you start testing it. You start running the program to see how it works when it's one quarter done. And it's the same with a wiki. I want you to be able to write a document where you got one quarter done and you could still sort of use it. Wow. And I think that idea, you know, we call it debugging a program into existence or emergent design or whatever you want to call it. You know, I knew how I wanted to program and how I wanted other people to try programming. And it was really this focus on programming. And I said, well, gee, I'll make a document system that kind of works the way I think you ought to program.
So WikiLinks are stubs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in some sense, a wiki at all times is useful. You can always just stop right now, and you have a reasonably linked document that has a fair amount of content, and it is related to each other and things. I think that really relates to what you went on to be a proponent of, which is this notion of extreme programming and delivering incremental successful releases on a daily or weekly basis. Are those related for you?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the programming, the Agile kind of predates Wiki. You know, I mean, it wasn't called Agile back then. We called it all. In fact, I'm not even sure it had a name, and we called refactoring, consolidation, and stuff like that. But, you know, there was this sense that the program needed to be open, that you weren't working against a master plan, or if you were, that plan got thrown out the window pretty quickly. And that it's really the people who can move around in the program and know their way and know where things belong. When somebody writes something and they write it in the wrong place, it really drives you nuts. Well, it's the same in a wiki. If they write it in the wrong page, it drives you nuts. But I saw it as very similar activities. And, of course, I was making this for programmers. So ultimately, the term for editing was called refactoring. People say, oh, yeah, we need to do some refactoring of this page. And, and what they really mean is editing. But, you know, we got that computer word into the wiki vernacular.
Did you ever write a formal spec for a wiki?
After the fact, I wrote a set of principles. I said, you know, I wasn't thinking about it. I mean, these were things I was thinking about, but I didn't write down. And, you know, maybe a year or two later, I can't quite remember how quickly I said, here's what I was trying to do. Here's things I knew I was thinking about, and I wrote them as principles. But no, I never wrote a spec.
Are those principles still around?
They're called Wiki Design Principles, and they're up on the wiki.
That's neat. And what did you change? What things did you rethink?
Well, I kind of misunderstood external linking. I had some crazy notation where you would put numbers in square brackets, and then you would go to a separate form to fill in what the external link was for that. And, you know, and then later on I realized, well, heck, I could just type in the text and recognize it. It's got that neat key like HTTP right in front of it. And so I got rid of those square brackets. That was crazy. And a few other small things, but mostly, you know, My original wiki looks a lot like it did on day one, and I've just decided to leave it that way. It looks a little old-fashioned, actually. It looks so, you know, 1995.
You're a hippie, Ward. And that's what I love about it. Look, these are the design principles. Open, incremental, organic, mundane. I like that. Universal, overt, unified, precise, tolerant, observable, convergent. And then you describe each concept.
Yes.
And it's very elegant. It's very beautiful. Very well thought out.
C2.com has got to be one of the oldest domains around, actually.
Yeah, I guess you can't get two other ones anymore. And
And there it is. There's your wiki right there at c2.com. It's just, this is incredible. The first wiki is still there. Is it still mostly the Perl code you wrote back in 95? Or
I've written probably five versions. You know, only the even number ones or odd numbers ones were ever very successful. Maybe it's even number. I don't know. I've written it over a couple of times, but that site is running on the first version.
Wow.
And it's. We should go through it sometime. I think it'd be a real hoot, you know, to see what I thought you had to do to write a CGI script.
And it's actually pretty simple. It's all flat files, if I remember right.
Well, I started out using those the DBM stuff. You know, I thought, oh, God, this is great. You know, a language has built-in access to a database. But that the DBM didn't really serve me well in the web server environment. You know, I guess it would... as people would cancel saves or something, it would wedge DBM.
Mm-hmm.
And it was with Perl 5, you had this ability to have different versions of the library, and that helped a little bit, but I never quite got it right. And so I added a flat file kind of backup, and I'd rebuild the DBM index from the flat files on a nightly basis. And then finally I said, well, let's just throw this DBM away and read the flat files, and everything got easy after that.
Wow.
And I got 30,000 files in one directory, and it just works great. That's funny. That wasn't supposed to work, but man, it works great.
I use a PHP wiki, PM wiki, that is also flat files, and that for a while they contemplated going to MySQL as Media Wiki does, and some other wikis, and flat files seem to work. There doesn't seem to be a need for a database, really.
Yeah, as long as you don't have too much aspiration, you know, as soon as you want to do really complicated things with user permissions or metadata or even complicated version management.
That is a strong testament to you. I think a phrase that's been quoted of you many times, which is do the simplest thing that could possibly work.
Occam's razor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how does that affect the wiki, and how does that affect your agile development?
Well, I have a little trick I like to do, and that is sometimes I write things a little simpler than you really need, and that is just an invitation for somebody else to come along and finish it.
It's kind of like a wiki.
I know I'm falling short on things like, you know, not bothering to do the login system, you know, but
Code Monkey can do that.
If you make something if you have an idea and you want people to accept it, you know, better to do an implementation that leaves out all the things that they already know and does very simply something that they would have trouble believing would work. And then they see it work and they say, well, this is great, but it left out all the stuff I know and I feel like putting it in. And that way everybody gets a chance to... to add their expertise while experiencing the new thing.
I like that.
Yeah, so it's worth making things. Well, of course, now if you're making a product, it's another story, you know, because you got to ship it and it's got to be good. But if you're giving code away on the net, you know, people don't want, not in the beginning anyway, a full featured system. You know, they want the, you know, how fast can I learn this thing? If I can learn it in a day, I'll do it before it, you know, and then it take learning it in a week. I don't know if I said that sentence right, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Now, I notice you're using MediaWiki and not something of your own creation necessarily on About Us. Was that a deliberate choice?
I think MediaWiki is probably one of the best wikis. You know,
and this is the wiki for those that are in our audience. This is the wiki that's used for Wikipedia.
Yes. Yeah, and they're a top 10 website, and we know that MediaWiki is up to that challenge.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, think of all the page views and, all the editors.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of stuff going on inside of MediaWiki, and we learned a lot by starting there.
What did they do differently?
We're actually in the process of we started by building alongside, and it's kind of growing to overtake the MediaWiki implementation is a version built in Ruby.
Oh, neat.
So that's been interesting to compare the Ruby code to the PHP code. And you can guess which one is shorter.
It's neat when you look at wiki implementations. There's wikis written in just about every language there is.
Oh, yeah.
It almost seems like that's a kind of a graduate student project. Write a wiki in the language of your choice. It's like you write a compiler or you write a wiki. But
yeah.
But a wiki's all about parsing, isn't it? I mean,
I think it's kind of the hello world of
it is
of web service applications.
There you go.
You know, it there was a smallest wiki contest on C2 a few years back, and the winner was I think it was four lines long.
Wow, 4 lines of what?
Yeah, of Perl, of course.
I was going to say Lisp. Yeah. Okay,
no Perl.
And I put some carriage returns in strategic places.
Yeah, you have to.
To 6 or 8 lines, but
wow.
You know, it's actually very informative to look at because I can highlight. In fact, I do this in a talk. I highlight the spans of characters that implement the various features, and usually there's. You know, it's 15 characters to do this and another 10 to do that.
Very terse.
Speaking of Ruby and Perl for websites and stuff, what do you think of the revival now of dynamic languages is becoming the new trend? Of course, for those of us that have been around since 95, this is an old trend. But what do you think of the revival of moving away from C++ and Java back towards Ruby and Perl and Smalltalk for websites?
Oh, it can't happen too fast, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's. I think that you know, there's a half a dozen errors that those complicated systems can find, and you know, if you use a dynamic language, you got to be on the lookout for them yourself because your compiler isn't going to find them. But there's 1,000 other mistakes that you make all the time that it just helps you get past. I think the dynamic language. Here's one thing I notice is that the quality of the frameworks. That are showing up in dynamic languages are much more interesting. The nature and the way they change things is much more interesting than any I've seen in static languages.
That's
and
true.
I think that's because the static languages just make it hard on framework authors.
You're talking about Rails, Django, things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah. Even jQuery on the client side is it's really interesting how. Programming, you know, client side on the browser is approached completely differently when you're working in that environment, and to be able to make that big a change. Whereas, I don't know. I don't want to start complaining about Java, but
go ahead.
Yeah,
well, you know, it just seems to take 10 objects to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, you it's just like you can't talk to somebody and say, here's what I want done, go do it, and expect any help. It's like, oh, no, prove to me you're good enough for me to do that for you. Prove to me that you can instantiate all the helpers and wrappers and whatever you need to get the job done. And, boy, if you do anything wrong, I'll refuse to run, that's for sure.
So you're saying that given the choice between the restrictions of a static typed language versus the extra frameworks and programmer productivity things of a dynamic language, the dynamic language will win.
Yeah, I think so. But we have to go back to the beginning of this conversation where we're talking about how valuable it is to run a program that's half done.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And when you start talking about what kind of support do I get for a program when it's half done? Well, you know, in Java, you know, basically it wants to check to make sure that all the pages are there. There's no such thing as a red link, right? You can't, it won't start if it can't find every single class you need.
Mm-hmm.
Now I say that, but of course there is dynamics built underneath. And if you put enough layers of stuff, you can make it as dynamic as a dynamic language, but it's you're swimming upstream. That's for sure.
But you clearly spend some time in both static languages, dynamic languages. So what's your conclusion based on that?
The one thing I can say about static languages is that it does, what of course, compilers can do more reasoning about your program before the program starts. And I'm just arguing that reasoning isn't all that much, and I'm not that impressed. I'd rather see a good test suite.
Mm.
But the one thing you do get is you get more powerful refactoring.
Yeah.
You know, the automatic refactoring tools seem to work a little better in the static languages. But boy, you need them a lot more. So I guess that's you get what you need.
And can you define refactoring? Because you've used that term a few times, and I'm kind of
that's when you make a change to a program where the real purpose is to change the way the program looks, not to add any new behavior. You know, it's like saying, "Gee, I have these three classes that are working, and I put too much functionality in the second class, and I want to take a little out of the second class and move it over to the first class."
It's part of the iterations that you would go through to kind of. Improve and optimize.
You know, I don't think you get this thing when you're done programming where you think, gosh, now I really know how to do it. I wish I'd done it a different way. And we just say, well, yeah, go ahead and do it a different way. It doesn't take that much more effort to make it right after you have it working. And of course, right is a value judgment. You know, it's like saying, you know, I got the right chapters in my book. How do you know whether you got the right chapters in your book? Well, you've got to write a book and let a few people read it and talk about it, live with it for a while. And then you say, gee, I wish chapter 2, you know, was pushed a little to the back and chapter 6 was brought up here in front and that kind of stuff. You know, it's the program's, you know, written to be read and you have to read it and live with it.
And that's part of what we would call now the buzzword extreme programming, right?
It's a very important part of extreme programming.
How would you define extreme programming?
Yeah, I mean, this is the guy. We got the guy here who created this whole concept. This is great. This is like talking to Yoda.
Without the voice.
Yeah, the verb's in the right spot. So what is extreme programming?
Extreme programming is a collection of practices that if you do them all, you will be able to make a clean code in an economical way.
Efficiently, you know? Swiftly, and it's production. Sometimes people think of static versus dynamic as production versus prototyping. Are you talking about prototyping here, or are you talking about production?
No, absolutely not. I'm talking about, you know, at the end of week one, you've got a week's worth of work, and you can use it.
Right.
At the end of week two, you got 2 weeks' worth of work, and you can use that. At the end of week three, you got 3 weeks' worth of work, and you can use that. And it's you need to be able to refactor your code, because in week one, you don't really understand what you're going to be thinking about on week three.
Right.
So what you don't want to do is write weeks one code as if it's never, ever going to change. But, week four comes along and maybe the project goals have shifted a little. It's been 4 weeks. And you just say, great, I'm glad that the project goals are shifted because I want to be working on the most important thing.
Right. This is the same as agile programming.
Yeah. Agile is an umbrella term. So extreme programming is, you know, one and probably the most complete of the many agile methodologies. I think what agile have in common is this idea that, you don't really know what you have until you have code. You know, you look at code, and another thing that's common to all of them is that we're working together. We're not divvying up the work and saying this is yours and this other is mine. It's like it's all ours, and we have to write the code in such a way that we're, you know, kind of all living in it together. And so, you approach a problem differently. There's less emphasis on having interfaces that you're going to hold still, and more emphasis on, is this code clean? When I go to a routine, do I see what I would expect there? And if not, then is it my expectation, or is that just routine in the wrong place?
Is there a type of programming problem that this would be better for or worse for, in your experience?
Well, there's a couple of things that will really sabotage an extreme programming project. And one is if there's some part of it that has huge lead times, you know, like maybe you're working on a hardware-software system and the hardware has to be spec'd out and fabricated 6 months before you get to write software. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you better know what that hardware has to do, because if you make a mistake, they're 6 months gone. Although, you know, modern hardware design is trying to be more and more like software, you know, so, we built the wrong hardware. Let's just reflash the parts and turn it into new hardware.
But, like, let's say I'm going to be the next Twitter.com. Okay, would this be kind of stuff applied directly to it, or
it's
is
written
this
in Rails, baby? Written in Rails.
Sure. Well, what's neat about Rails is that Rails presumes from the beginning that you're using an agile methodology. In fact, it's very well supported. So, you know, if you just do Rails the way it's intended, you know, you're doing agile without even having to brag about it.
How did the Academy react to this concept? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, the old school guys, the Donald Knuths. This is kind of the antithesis of what they said, which is write a complete spec and so forth.
Oh,
waterfall design.
I think Don Knuth, to name names, is always been agile.
He'd probably love it. I shouldn't use him as an example, but
right. But there is this kind of middle tier, after Don, but
yeah, his books were written in this pseudo code that really was agile. I mean
you know, there was a time where people said, gee, we wish computer programming were more like civil engineering.
Yes. Yes.
And they said, well, can you teach our employees how to make a program without getting all balled up with, delays? and that was a reasonable thing to ask for because delays are expensive.
And then you get ADA.
But yeah, well, or worse, you get these things that just produce pictures. They say, oh, well, if you just design it ahead of time so you don't have any of this decision-making on the fly, if you just let everybody be stupid.
Right.
You know, well, the thing is they didn't realize they were throwing out the baby with the bathwater, that a lot of really creative decision-making happens while you're programming.
Programming is an art as opposed to programming as engineering.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Programming is reasoning about the future. You know, and then making decisions about what will happen in the future based on that reasoning.
And now, three by five cards versus UML.
Oh, you're softballs to me. There was a lot of methodologies being kicked around when I was learning objects, and of course, I learned them all from Smalltalk, and I would see these beautiful interactions, things that were just so clever, and I'm digging around the code to find them. But then people would say, well, here's how to design objects. And I thought, well, you know, your notation doesn't even allow the representation of the coolest objects I've seen in Smalltalk. You know, they don't fit. I can't describe them. And if I can't describe them, I'm certainly not going to invent them. So I needed some way to talk about what happened inside a small talk that showed the cool things you could do with objects without overwhelming, people. And so what the card does is, you know, you kind of write a class name on a card, and when you're handling it, you know, you're sort of thinking, well, here's some instance of this card, and you march it across the table, you know, like a little puppet. And you're telling a story. You're telling a story of what these objects are going to do. And just because you told one story doesn't mean you won't pick them up and tell another story in another minute. But after you've told about 10 or 15 stories, you get a feeling whether those objects are the right objects or not. And maybe you cross a few things off of one card and write them on another, and you've just done some refactoring. And so by using index cards, which were really just enough to keep track of what you think you're going to program, you can get a real feel for what that program is going to be like, and then you program it.
So each card is an object? Is that how
each card, I like to write the name of a class on a card, and I think of it as all the objects of that class.
I see.
But then when you're laying them, you got all the classes that you're going to have to write, and of course when your program runs, there'll be, you know, thousands or millions of each of those classes, or instances of class.
Right.
But when you're telling a story, when the card is in your hand, you're talking about it as if it's a particular instance. So this notion of class and instance, you know, was kind of natural just in handling the cards.
Yeah,
and
you instantiate it by picking it up.
Yeah. Say, for instance, this one right here. Right.
But it really was beautiful. I mean, it just in its simplest elegance. You know, here you are with just 3x5 cards. You're able to work out the layout of your program, the interactions of your program, and then all these fancy things have come along since then. But, you know, go back to the 3x5 cards, go back to the simple whiteboard to describe really what your program does. And if you can't communicate it that way, it's probably too complex of a design.
Although I like the cards because, unlike the board, you can change. You could show flow.
Yeah.
And you could show instantiation by picking up the card.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
So here's a cool thing, and I think that this is Ron Jeffries developed this technique. He called it white carding. And they were in control of their software enough that they knew what every object was. And when they went and looked for an object, they knew just what they wanted. And sure enough, it was right and so forth. Except every now and then when they're doing new functionality, they'd say, oh, this new functionality doesn't fit in. And they'd stop making progress at the computer screen. They'd say, oh, let's go to the cafeteria, you know, get a cup of coffee and we'll bring some cards. And they'd bring blank cards. And then they would design without writing anything on the cards.
Ooh.
They would just lay them out on the table and they say, this card is going to be this object, and this card is going to be that, and this other card is this other object. And they'd look around. You remember that? Okay, this. And then they start moving the cards around and doing all the motion and the describing and telling the stories. But they figured if they got a design that was so complicated that they couldn't remember what each card was supposed to be like, if you have more than three cards, you know, so they got to the point where they wouldn't take more than three cards, because if they figured they couldn't solve the problem with only three objects, you know, that they were thinking too complicated. So let's just figure out the three-object solution and then go back and implement that and then see where we're at. And maybe they get one object wrong, but then they just fix that tomorrow and refactor. You know, it's all aimed at keeping you from solving too many problems at once. Keeping you focused on what is it I really need to do today, and how can I do it well in a way that I can live with tomorrow.
Is that because the limitations of the brain, the complexity, you can't hold it?
I think it's more the limitations of our ability to foretell the future. You know, because, boy, if you make three objects, you can do a lot with three objects. Right. And once you get to know them, you'll have a lot of ideas that you didn't have before you made them.
Yep.
You know, it's really more what you learn from running a program. And why not just do three now, feel them, and then see what we think of tomorrow.
Now you've been around...
When I talk about feeling a program, you know who's going to do the feeling. It's the developers. And I think that's one reason why this makes people nervous, because they say, well, you know, my developer has long hair, and I don't know if I trust him to be feeling my business process and making decisions that I don't understand. And, you know, part of that is, you know, a lot of extreme programming is, well, we got to get these guys who love computer programming. They have to understand the business problems. They got to get to know the users personally. They got to begin to think like a user so that they can empathize. And on top of that, they also have to know the object. So many of the extreme programming practices have to do with how you interact with the people around you who don't think like you do.
Now, from the beginning, I mean, you've been around this for like 10, 15 years in object-oriented programming and working with Smalltalk and things like that. What's been the biggest change over the last decade in terms of extreme programming, agile programming?
Oh, I would say processor cycle time. You know, it took a real leap of faith to believe that we could write a bunch of tiny little subroutines and not worry about the cost of a subroutine call, you know, you know, before the, you know, in the 70s, people really did care, you know, oh, we want to do a long routine because we're going to count how many activation records we want to make. Right. And in Smalltalk, it sort of said, oh, no, you know, you want to write the smallest routine. You want to really chop your thinking up and make a bunch of atomic little things that all just have the right name. And who cares?
So in that sense, Smalltalk was actually foreseeing the fact that we'd have more CPU than programmer power long in the future, right?
I think so, yeah. And it, you know, there were a lot of slow Smalltalk programs were written back then, too, because it really didn't have the horsepower, you know, but it does now. It just amazes me. But I'll tell you, you know, after apologizing for Smalltalk's performance for 15 years, when I finally got on a modern PC and started running, and I'll say it again, started running Perl, the thing that struck me most is just how fast it compiled and just how fast it ran. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how they did it. It was so damn fast that it opened up new possibilities that were unavailable to me in Smalltalk. Smalltalk, of course, was great because it opened up tons of possibilities that weren't available to me in C. But, you know, I used Perl in Unix, which I'd stayed away from Unix for 10 years. Well, 5 years. But I use that to remember approaches that I might have taken to software that could scale now that wouldn't then. Hmm. And yeah, it was great.
What
is that? Me? Is that
no,
me
that's,
beeping
that's
there?
Me. I apologize. I don't know what it is, but it's, okay. it's you won't hear it again. I've taken care of it.
Ever
I thought
again.
Maybe I thought maybe I said Perl one too many times.
Have you ever taught programming to younger people, Ward?
You know, I taught both of my kids. They didn't want to learn to program, but I said you either got to get a job this summer or you got to learn to program.
That's great. And what did and how did you go about it?
Did
you sit them down with small talk or?
Nah, I did Java, and I said here's a good tutorial. Read a page of that, and then let's write a program that that's kind of fun. And gosh, the now this was kind of a cool story. The my younger son wanted to do graphical things, and one of the first projects in the graphics tutorial was to draw circles on a widget. No, what do you call it? In a Java applet, to put an applet in a web page, and when it opened, it would just put a bunch of random circles up there. And, well, that was fun because he had a web page and he had friends that browse the web. And so he'd call his friends and say, hey, you got to go look at my web page with the random circles on it. But then he says, okay, I want to write a computer program that computes pi.
Oh. How old is he at the time?
He might have been a freshman in high school.
Okay.
But I said, well, okay, let's take that program that produces circles, and we'll shrink the circles down to be small dots. And we'll just generate random dots until we cover the whole screen. And that took, you know, the program ran for a few seconds, and the screen was peppered with dots. And instead of making them all different colors, let's just make them red if they're within, you know, 100 pixels of the origin, and we'll make them blue if they're outside 100 pixels from the origin. And so we had to put in Pythagorean theorem, which he knew. And sure enough, we got a big red quarter circle on a field of blue. And I said, well, if we now just modify the program to count how many red circles,
oh boy,
then I think we'll have a, you know, something that has to do with pi.
What a great way to teach.
Yeah, and he looked at that and he says, well, yeah, but what's the formula? And I said, I don't do formulas. You know, ask your mother. She's a math major.
That's great.
But he learned it.
Well, the best thing is he had to go down and ask his mother, which meant he had to explain to his mother what he had just done.
Oh, neat.
And then, of course, she would have blown me off, but, you know, he's asking a question. So she sat down there and figured out, you know, how to take, you know, because what we're really doing is measuring the area of a quarter circle and figure out how to compute pi from area.
Wow, is that neat?
Yeah, I just thought it was cool. So I think now that's called repurposing, or, you know, I took their little demo program and I made a mashup and turned it into to a Monte Carlo integrator.
But, very cool.
You know, I never said Monte Carlo to him. Not until he had an answer.
Have they stayed in the computer business or still have that interest?
No, I don't think so. Later, my older boy said, well, yeah, it was okay, but we didn't want to compete with you. And
I don't blame him. It's hard. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing I said is, you know, they said, why do you want us to learn how to program? And I said, well, you'll go off to college someday and some professor's going to learn that you're my son. And I would be embarrassed if I didn't at least try.
My father was a geologist, and I signed up for a geology.
And I don't know what dirt is.
No, I did. I signed up for a geology course. And the first thing the professor says, we're going to expect great things of you. I dropped that course in like a week. You can't live up to that. So I can understand that, you know. Find something else.
Now you still
the young one's studying biology at the moment.
Oh, that's cool. That's great.
Yeah, biology school. The older boy is in business and working for the university.
Great.
So C2.com, I'm still a little curious about that. Are the pages there been mostly there since the beginning, or are most of them new, or what?
Most of the pages, you know, I think we hit 20,000 pages, maybe 4 years in.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was kind of a movement then. They said, well, maybe 20,000 is enough. So let's as the page count goes up, let's see if we can keep finding pages to delete. And I thought that was a really smart move. You know, let's find worthless pages and delete them to keep it at 20,000.
And I think you told me at some meeting we were at.
I think right now it's 30,000. So, yeah. But plateaued.
At a meeting you told me, I think a year ago, that there was some sort of weird collection of pages that were not related to computer software, that sort of camped into C2. Do I remember this right? Was there religious pages?
There were developers who, you know, like to talk about their favorite science fiction characters, and that was okay, you know, because it kind of defines who you are, what, you know, or whether you like you know, Iron Chef and but early on there was a discussion of religion, and I thought you know, guns and religion were the two things that would surely bring this thing to pieces, it started out very academic, but, you know, as more people got involved, you know, more feelings were getting hurt. And the fellow who really did the most authoring, you know, loved the wiki and he wanted to start his own. And I said, why don't you take all those religion pages and just move them to your own wiki.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
And they went over there and they fought and fought bitterly over there. And so getting rid of them was a smart move.
Now nuclear winter on that website.
Yeah. A lot of hurt feelings, too.
That's too bad.
Now, when you created the open wiki like that, did you have this fear that if anybody could edit it, anybody could delete it, anybody could, like, vandalize it?
When I made it, I thought, boy, if this thing lasts 6 months, it'll be great. But, you know, by the time it lasted 2 years, I knew that it was a much bigger success than I'd even hoped for. And so all of a sudden, I was kind of protective about it. In fact, John Udell was writing for Byte magazine at the time, and he wrote me a note. He says, well, I'm writing about groupware for Byte, and I'd love to talk about your website. And I said, well, you know, I don't think publishing the URL of my website in Byte is I don't think it would survive it. And so he passed. You know, it was, you got to know it by, you know, finding a friend of a friend. And it didn't really become publicly known until there were already hundreds, maybe thousands of wikis. The wiki kind of got out and spread through the community. Wikipedia existed before the fact that there was this community dealing with computer programming pages. And around that time, Google got so good and started indexing it. And then we had a lot of traffic who would just find pages there and not even realize they'd dropped into some computer programmer's den. But the computer programmers were already writing about nuclear physics and stuff like that. And so sometimes it, you know, was apropos.
Now, speaking of computer programming, I understand that somebody on your staff, maybe even you, had listened to a previous episode of this very podcast, Lost Weekly, and got inspired to consider Git. Is that accurate?
Oh, we love Git. We got developers in all over the world, and managing this, you know, you can't do Agile with, you know, it just presumes that you've got a good source code management, but, you know, the server-based stuff is, you know, a struggle, and we learned Git. We watched the video, too. There's a great video of Randall explaining it all. You know, you have to watch it twice because it goes by so quick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I speak at high speed. I remember that. That was a crazy one. They gave me 40 minutes to do what was like an hour and a half talk. Yeah.
Here's Git.
Yeah. You know, you can't absorb it until you use it. So you use it a while, and then you go study it some more, and then you say, oh, now I see why I need that command.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we were... we were getting along fine, but, you know, just as we started doing new and very different things, instead of just finishing the, you know, the current thrust, started thinking about the new thrust, we really had to get branching to work, and we had been avoiding that. And Randall was kind enough to come over and spend a lunch hour with us and kind of walk us through branching. And
isn't that nice of you?
Yeah, Randall so sure is nice, but that's working great for us. There's the rebasing, is the one other thing he suggested, and we haven't quite mastered that. That is definitely black belt get.
Absolutely.
And so we're happy with our green belt performance. But
well, our audience has asked us to ask everybody we talk to from now on what their development environment of choice is currently. So we should ask you that. We know you're using Git. Are you still using Perl, or what are you working?
For myself, I write Perl in Vi. I just tell, I SSH into my server and I just start writing Perl. And I've developed enough technique that I can do, the stuff I need just to live, in programs that are under a page, and write them as CGIs. But I'm pretty old school in that regard, I mean, that was a technology that was developed, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I don't know when CGI was invented, but, it just suits me. Now, what we're using here at About Us is really what we like to do is we like to work in on Macintoshes with these big 31-inch monitors, and we use TextMate as the editor, and we write Ruby on Rails and on the back end, and we use jQuery on the front end.
Wow.
And it's a nice combination. We've got a lot of PHP and MediaWiki in there, too, that we work with. And, every now and then a C program and every now and then a Perl program. But, the trouble is if I write Perl here, it tends to get kind of lost. Whereas if I still feel more comfortable in Perl than I do in Ruby. But, if we try to get 90% of our code in at least in the same language, then we're better off. And it's, it's these quick to compile, I figure any, if you can't knock off a call to system with backticks, you're not in a real language.
Right.
It's that ability to reach out and get your job done that, that I love with those, all of those in the same environment. Now, if I start thinking about my ideal, gosh, I don't know. I think that I think we've yet to fully integrate unit testing with language design, and that there'll be another generation of dynamic languages where there's a rich test expression syntax, and I've played with that a little bit in I/O. I/O, capital I, little O, is a very small language that is a prototype-based, object-oriented language. Mm-hmm. And it is lispish enough that you can kind of reach up and grab the parameters that were passed into you and sort of treat them like a parse tree and do things with them. And I like that, and so I've experimented with making the unit testing be just part of the program and not something that's tacked on the side. And I think that what I can do in I/O is suggestive of what it could be like if real language designers just assumed that unit tests were a valuable part, more valuable than type declarations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I think that's and when that's done, and when the editors know how to interpret that, in the same way that an editor really needs to know how to enough syntax to color code, well, it should know enough syntax to be kind of reasoning, running my tests. I should be able to like click a test, and it should light up my program in a different way than if I clicked another test.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So not reasoning by doing some crazy type algebra, but reasoning by actually running my program.
Cool.
You've really influenced programming so much with this notion of extreme programming, and it seems to be accepted by everybody these days. Is there anything you see, any programming practice you see people using today that just drives you crazy and you wish they would just stop? You're going to be politic. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to think. I mean, I'm sure there is. I get annoyed all the time, but I just haven't remembered.
It's a tough question because it's like you got to call on your stack and look through that stuff. You don't still have that old HyperCard stack, by the way, lying around.
Oh, I wish I did. I'm sure I have it on a disk, but I just don't have anything to put the disk into. Or
got a 3.5-inch floppy somewhere.
You got to find it. It's historic. You got to find it. It's probably property of Tektronix, but still, find it. Yeah. You know, it's...
I have this interpreter that'll run the original Macintosh software, and that looks great, you know, to bring up the original Mac 1.0 software on this 31-inch monitor. And if I just had a disk image of HyperCard,
there you go.
You know, I'd be all set. I'd just love to have it running.
There are still HyperCard interpreters around that people keep this stuff alive.
Well, you know, the trouble is it's one of those things where you have to kind of know somebody, wink, wink.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not legal.
It's Apple.
So there's some, now that you mention it, I think it's really ridiculous to write software that other people can't modify and share.
Right on.
You know, let's just say that is so much a part of making anything useful. And I didn't really understand that. I mean, when I worked for Tektronix, I mean, I just knew I was working for Tektronix, and I didn't think I'd ever work anywhere else, and I just didn't worry about it. But, you know, about that time, the free software movement was starting, and I thought, well, that's interesting. I guess that makes sense, but it didn't touch me. And then I went off, and I did Smalltalk for a while, and I was explaining objects, and I came back, and I found this... You know, the net had started, and I needed to be on the net, and I got this Unix system going, a Linux with Perl and all that other stuff. And I said, God, where did this come from? This is great. Where did all this come from? And, it's like it wasn't even a big deal that it was there. And, it was the open source movement. And it just sort of happened without me watching. But then I was the beneficiary of it. So I've spent a lot of time recently kind of studying – well, I talk about programming, and without talking about who owns the program, but boy, if you're gonna have an impact on the world, you've got to give your code away. And not only that, it's not easy to give away. You have to support it, and that's one thing that's been a struggle for me. By support it, I mean when people start sending your patches, you've got to look at those patches and put them in. And that's it's a discipline on top of a discipline, and extreme programming doesn't say anything about that, but doing that well. Is something that I've only really appreciated in the last few years as I've tried to answer that question. You know, where does all this great stuff come from, and how did these guys get so smart?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a perfect coda for this program, since that's what we talk about.
Yeah, I didn't think that's anything special for you, but it's the same thing with data. You know, if you build a website and collect a lot of data, you got to make that data available. You can't take somebody's data and say, no, it's mine now. It's got to be, Creative Commons or something like that. It's the only sensible thing.
Yeah.
Completely.
Otherwise, we're just not going to go forward. Yeah. Not fast enough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's good for the ecology.
Yep.
Well, Ward, it's been such a pleasure, such an honor, in fact, to talk to you. We thank you so much for your contributions and for spending some time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, thank you. It was good questions, great conversations, and
no kidding.
I look forward to being a regular listener.
Well, good. Thank you, Ward.
Definitely.
All right. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Wow, what an honor. I'll tell you. Let me hang up on him before we start singing his praises. He's still here.
Hey.
What an amazing conversation. It's good when we get to talk to the legends, the people that set the platform that most of us work within. This has really been a privilege.
Well, two in a row. And, Richard Hipp last time on SQLite, mm-hmm. and Ward, both are, I hate to kind of make it airy-fairy, but spiritual in a way. I mean, certainly Richard is spiritual, actively spiritual, but in a sense that what they're doing is not plumbing. They are creating something bigger.
Yes, absolutely. And just you know, the what he was addressing day by day was just what it takes to get the job done. But in the process, because he had to invent things that were in a space that wasn't defined yet, he had to come up with things like agile programming, right, and how to work with objects, and how do we work, you know, let's pull out 3x5 cards and work out the relationships between
that.
Them. And
I love
it. And even like the wiki, like I need to have a whiteboard here. I need a virtual right. whiteboard that everybody can edit and manipulate and to just solve problems in the most straightforward way and have those be the seminal deciders for how it would be done for the rest of us.
Well, and the thing he said at the end of how important it is that software be given away, be open source. And then the second side of it, that you continue to support it and, you know, pay attention to it. Like Richard Hipp, here's a guy who could have made a lot of money making Wiki a proprietary thing and owning it. And it would never have taken off. It would never have been what it is today.
No, we wouldn't be chatting about Wikipedia today had, you know, what Ward had set up would be like some little subscriber-only site. It would not have been the same thing at all, and it would not have had the impact that it's had for us.
It's exactly what he said. The willingness to let go and to give it out and put it out in the world changes the world. And you look at Linux, you look at all open-source software. The very openness of it is what allows it to be so important.
Well, that's why I spend every day talking about it. That's why, you know, I've made a living for 20 years helping people to understand how to use free software. And it's been incredible because it's really this community potluck where everybody can take a piece and give a piece back, creates this wonderful community, this wonderful everybody building everybody else's work. And these pioneers that we've got a chance to talk to through this podcast series have just been incredible because that's where the work comes from. That's the visionaries. That's the people that let me do my job day by day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really neat. Real honor. Mm-hmm. We're going to wrap it up, but thank you for bringing us such great guests. I just got a Twitter from Daniel Jaikut, who's a programmer for the Macintosh. He works for Red Sweater. He does Mars Edit and some really great stuff. And he just said, you guys have been on fire lately. He said, I decided to contribute for the first time and a long overdue contribution to Twit because I want to thank you for what you're doing with Floss. We're getting a lot of email like that. And Randall, I give you full props and credit for it because
thank you. I mean, it's just been and again, I've gotten probably 15 suggestions just in the last week since our last taping of new ideas for who to talk to with Floss Weekly, and I'm going to be pursuing all those. You know, I'll get to each one of those. We're going to get some seriously interesting shows coming up, and Leo, I have to thank you for giving me the vehicle to go ahead and keep pursuing these people because this has been really wonderful.
Good. Well, we're having a good time. We thank you for joining us, and I can't wait to see the next one on Floss Weekly.